Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, the government scheme to help those with low deposits buy a home is up and running. Nationwide, on board, but they have addressed a big issue with the scheme by upping the amount that first-time buyers can borrow to 5.5% of their salary, 20% more than most, which, not a bad thing, given official figures showing house prices are up almost 9% in a year, the fastest rise since 2014. While prices are going great guns, we ask if buy-to-let is still a good investment. Also today, we have more on Barclaycard, slashing of credit limits. Simon has discovered what his is now. And finally, can we get any more peak lockdown? Can I stick solar panels on my shoffice? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, the government's new 95% mortgage guarantee scheme launched this week. Now, it's aimed at increasing the number of deals available to those who have little in the way of a deposit or have limited equity. Now, one of the big problems, for first-time buyers especially, is the low loan-to-income ratio that most lenders will offer. Upsteps nationwide, who are not taking part in the government scheme. They say they're not ready to offer 95% mortgages, but are offering their own helping hand to those wanting to get onto the property ladder. But first of all, Lee, the government's new scheme announced in the budget by Rishi Sunak, what is it and what does it hope to achieve?
Hi, Georgie. It's more government mortgage market meddling. I would say it's basically what it says on the tin. You know, it's for basically buyers who want to get onto the property ladder, but are struggling to get a 10% deposit together. And you know, the number of mortgages that are available with 5% deposits have been completely lampooned, especially since the start of the pandemic. They were already a fairly niche product anyway, just because of the financial crisis. A lot of people found themselves in negative equity and all that kind of stuff. So that kind of lending had wasn't the norm. You know, most people would look to save 10% deposit of a home. Now, on a £250,000 home, a 10% deposit is 25 grand. 5% is 12.5 grand. That's a sizable difference. And there's stats out there suggesting that 4 in 5 private renters at the moment are now cobbling money together. They're saving to get a deposit to get onto the property ladder. So you can see what the issue is there. It's expensive to rent, so it becomes difficult to save. And it becomes difficult. That first hurdle, that biggest hurdle of getting a deposit together, is what this scheme is looking to solve. Now, as I say, it's nothing new. And as a borrower, there's nothing you really need to know other than big banks have got involved in this. So from this week, from this Monday, we've got Lloyds, Santander, Barclays, HSBC, NatWest. They've all got involved in this. There's now mortgages available to you, 5% deposits, but normal usual lending lending criteria remains. So it's 4.5 times your salary. That's still the sort of rule of thumb if you're looking to borrow. And some of the rates on offer, they're quite high. Compared to what has been record lows for mortgages, especially for people perhaps with 80% LTV or lower than that, you know, you can get mortgages for a percent rate at the moment, which is absolutely crazy. We say this all the time, and it's like, how long can this go on for? But they're the kind of rates we're looking at for the best buy. So there's 38 of these deals that have come available this week. 2-year fix on NatWest at 3.9%, which is it's a pretty steep rate, and then over 5 years. Actually, it's building societies that are not part of this scheme that are actually offering better rates. So, for example, for Coventry, you get 3.89%, and with Leeds and Yorkshire, 3.99% with 5% deposits. These products are already there anyway. The big difference with this, as I say, is that big banks have got back involved. That gives a little bit more confidence into the market and into the housing market. And for the lender, the scheme gives that kind of guarantee, that government backing, that it will shoulder some of the cost if the lender loses money. So, for example, if a home's repossessed because the borrower can't keep up with mortgage payments, they can recoup some of the money via that government kind of backing. It can't be used on new builds, or most of them can't be used on new builds, which is quite a big caveat worth pointing out there. As I say, it's It's more of a symbol of big banks getting back into the sort of arena in 5% deposit mortgages, Georgie, if I'm being honest, what this is all about. And as I say, it's just another example of government mortgage meddling. And it's quite a hot property market at the moment, as we've seen with house price rises we're going to talk about in a little while. This is more fuel for the fire, perhaps.
So it's government hoping that this is going to stimulate banks to do something, which I guess is nationwide stepping in there. They're not going to be offering the 95%. They will offer 90% with T's and C's and caveats and all that sort of thing. But, you know, that loan income ratio, they're changing. So I guess there's, you know, in terms of looking at the bigger picture, is it sort of steps in the right direction? Or you're just thinking, just back off, for goodness sake. Stop meddling. Let the market work itself out, if we could ever say that about the housing market.
You could. There's pros and cons to that argument, Georgie. I mean, at the end of the day, if you're someone that's struggling to get a deposit together and can only get 5% together rather than 10%, it's hard to tell those people that, no, you can't get on the property ladder and that this is a bad idea. But in the same breath, I find it sometimes the government and the obsession with the property market can sometimes be a bit much. And actually, with the nationwide building society saying actually they're not launching a 5% mortgage at the moment, and they may look at doing so in the coming months, but at the moment it's not a priority for them. 10% is their minimum lending criteria, and this week they've said that yes, they will up the income ratio to 5.5. So instead of 4.5 times earnings, it'll be 5.5 times earnings, which is doesn't sound like much, but actually can be quite a substantial rise. But there's a big caveat in this, Georgie, in the fact that it will only be £1 billion. So I said only £1 billion, but that actually is quite a drop in the ocean for what is the second biggest mortgage lender in Britain. And it probably means that only about 5,000 households will take advantage of that, because it will run out pretty quick when, you know, average house price is sort of £250,000. So I reckon that'd be really popular. That doesn't happen until this Monday coming, so the 26th of April. I've got a funny feeling that that's going to prove really quite popular, because it's just another barrier that lending criteria, that income, the stress test, all of that kind of stuff, and whether you can afford the mortgage or not is another barrier. So that is probably, I would say, the second next barrier after getting a deposit together.
Simon, what do you make of all of this?
I think that the government should stop meddling in the housing market. I think that the decisions to continually try to deal with the fact that houses are too expensive compared to wages, almost as expensive compared to wages as they've ever been, by finding a way to lend people more money is counterproductive, because all you end up doing is increasing house prices. And for all the arguments about, oh, we just need to build more houses, there's a weight of academic research that shows the thing that drives house prices higher is the availability of credit. Is a 95% mortgage the problem? Not necessarily, because actually, if you look at the mortgage statistics, the long-run mortgage statistics, people now, first-time buyers, typically put down larger deposits than they did for our parents' generation. The people who bought in the 80s, early 90s, were putting down smaller deposits than they do now. And in fact, even though we talk about the boom years of the 2000s, the credit boom, the mortgage madness at that point, the Northern Rock era, the 125% mortgages and so on, people were actually on average putting down bigger deposits through those years as first-time buyers than they were through the other years. I think the main issue is actually the amount of money that you will lend people. It's the stretching of mortgage multiples, you know. So the big issue through those mortgage boom years was lenders kept upping and upping and upping the amount income multiple of someone's salary that they would lend people. And also you went from people buying with one income to it always having to be two incomes. So that kind of stretches it further. So it's almost more of an issue what nationwide is doing in terms of lending people more money than it is the 95% deposit stuff. But I can see why people get worried about the 95% deposit stuff, because should the government really be underwriting 5% deposit mortgages? If lenders have decided that they were so worried at the start of the pandemic that they were going to pull these, or blamed it on the fact that they couldn't deal with all the applications due to mortgage holidays and everything. And it was a combination of those two things, but they were definitely trying to throttle demand and they were concerned about house prices. Should you just wait for them to come back? I mean, they probably would have come back by themselves. There'd already been quite a bit of movement in the market of people offering more of these mortgages anyway. House prices are going up. There's that slightly more buoyant feeling. Lenders are going, well, maybe this doesn't look as bad as it did do, and maybe we'll be all right, and the mortgages would come back. But I do think that overall, probably the solution is to let house prices hit a ceiling, right? By not continually lending people more money, and then we hope that when they hit that ceiling, they sort of deflate or stabilize, and that wages catch up rather than crash. Obviously, the way markets move is they tend to be a bit more volatile than the hopeful. We'll just hope they float up and then just stay there kind of thing. But just lending people more money isn't the answer. On a personal level, however, if you're living in a rented flat and you've managed to save £12,500, which is a 5% deposit on the average home, and you can get a mortgage and you've got someone, you know, you're buying with someone else, so the two of you on your joint incomes can afford to get a mortgage that would get you that £237,500 mortgage that would get you that property. And actually, if you did that, you'd be paying a couple of £100 a month less on the mortgage than you are on rent, and you get a 5-year fixed rate mortgage. So by the time you know what your payment's going to be for 5 years, by the time those 5 years are up, you've paid down some of the mortgage. House prices have maybe risen a bit, so you've got a little bit more equity, then it looks like a no-brainer. And that's the problem, I think, with talking about any of this housing market and property stuff, is you've got, on one level, you've got what's called the macro stuff, the big picture stuff, the what is this madness? And on the other hand, you've got the personal stories of people who are like, well, look, I'm paying my landlord, you know, £1,500 a month in rent, and the mortgage would only be £1,200. It would be much better to get the mortgage. And you, I find it on a personal level, you know, whilst you warn someone about the risk of house prices going down as well as up and all that kind of stuff, you know, I find it very difficult to argue with that.
I'm glad you did mention that, because, you know, it's a very hard sell to someone who's wanting to get on the property ladder, spending all their money on rent and saying, do you know what? I know you can't afford it now, but just wait, because the market might come down. It might be more affordable for you. Yeah. And the more time you've got, the more you can save.
And then you're sitting there going, okay, well, at least over the last year, we've done some lockdown savings. We've saved up some money. But, oh, hang on, I've just read a report that the average house price has gone up by 20 grand. So exactly. even if you are buying with a 10% deposit, you're only going to need to find 2 grand of that, only 2 grand on top of all the money you've already saved. It's going to take a while. But you're going to have to borrow another 18 anyway. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you're going to have to borrow another 18, you know, and you could have bought with the 5% deposit rather than saving the extra bit for the 10% deposit, like, you might as well just go for it. I mean, to be honest, if I was in that position where my rent was more than my mortgage, I could raise the 5% deposit, I was fully aware of the risks and I was happy to take them on, I'd do it.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the average house prices. You didn't just pluck that figure out of thin air. That is actually the true rise in the average cost of home now over the last year, believe it or not. That is according to official figures. Separate data also showing property sales doubled in March compared to 12 months previously. So lots of activity. Lee, I think I know the reason, but why is property price inflation hitting 8.6% in the year to February, marking the highest annual rate of growth since 2014?
Well, that's a pertinent question, Georgie. There's actually two reasons. So the first real obvious one is the stamp duty holiday. Now, since last summer, that first part of the house has been at 0%, and people have taken advantage of that and been rushing through house sales, and we've seen property prices just going through the roof. Now, in sort of February, March time, there was a lot of people trying to rush their purchases through because they thought the stamp duty holiday was going to be coming to an end. But that was extended till the end of June and then tapers off at the end of September. So for that reason, people have been trying to get their purchases through to avoid being stung by potentially £15,000 of stamp duty, that first £15,000, which is for the majority of people, they would never pay over that amount. So there's been that. But the other big reason for that is people are actually snapping up bigger homes. So in the ONS stats, for example, it said that detached prices are actually up 9.1%, so even higher than the average. So, and flats are up 6.7%. So there's quite a big disparity there in growth. People are looking for more space. They're looking for gardens. They've been looking basically to grow, you know, and seeing this as the ideal time to buy to sort of dodge that stamp duty bill. And that has just put the absolute steam up the market. I mean, it really has gone like the clappers. I mean, it's been incredible. And a lot of property experts are saying now we're coming into that sort of summer rush when people tend to start to look to move, right? People prefer to sort of move home at this time of year between sort of now and the end of summer. And then now experts are saying that it's all going to sort of cool by the autumn. But I'm sure we were hearing about this was all going to cool before. And then, of course, the stamp duty holiday got extended. So who knows what's around the corner, but it's been an incredible sort of 9 months or so for property prices. And £20,000 is a pretty big jump in essentially what has been about 8 or 9 months.
Lee, whatever we think about, you know, government help schemes and all that sort of thing, isn't there a situation, though, that especially in certain areas, you know, buyers are being squeezed out, you know, as property affordability gets increasingly stretched? So, you know, we're in danger of just saying, okay, you're rich, you can have a house. You're not rich. Oh, sorry about that. If we don't have those help schemes.
I get that, Georgie. I do understand. But then it's almost like it goes full circle, doesn't it? Because then these schemes come out and then they make house prices go up even further. And then it's kind of like, when do we stop propping up? When does the government stop propping up the housing market? I'm saying, hey, first-time buyers, you know, here's some schemes for you to get onto the ladder. P.S., you know, these same schemes are putting prices up. And actually, you know, it is a problem across the country, but, you know, especially in London and the South East, you know, it's incredibly expensive to buy a property in London. It's extremely expensive to buy a property in the commuter parts on the outskirts of London. And, you know, people are struggling to get onto the ladder there. Did these schemes help? It's hard to say. I personally speaking, I'm not keen on this constant government meddling in the property market, but that's my opinion.
It is utterly mad, that disparity across the country. I mean, I think about where I grew up. It's a little town in Surrey. All my family are still there, and they just had a hideous new development. Starting prices are £417,000 for a one-bedroom flat.
Well, it's the same around here, Georgie.
Can you imagine what you get while living in North Yorkshire for that? There's a mansion.
There's a massive development going up around the corner here, and like the starting prices are £400,000. You know, and I just think, oh, that's a lot of money. And I'm not joking. The local estate agents around here in the last 3 to 6 months, they must have, I don't know, a whole forest must have disappeared from the amount of leaflets I've had through the door saying houses on your street are selling like hotcakes. Did you know the price of your property has gone up X% in the last few years? Is it now time for you to sell? And I just feel like saying, stop putting this thing through the post. Like, I'm happy living here. You know, we don't all see property moving and jumping around. Some of us like the stability of being in a home that we've lived in for a long time. Or, you know, if it's time for me to sell, I will put the house up for sale. You know, I don't need estate agents to keep telling me I'm ramping up the market even more. I should have kept hold of some of these leaflets, Georgie, because they've been absolutely comical. You know, it's almost like these estate agents are just scrambling to get me to bliss my home. And I'm just, I don't know what to say, really. It's like, just stop destroying the planet with your leaflets.
As I say, I hope you're putting them in recycling, Lee.
I am.
Or doing something creative with your daughter. Simon, the solution, it feels like there's a couple of elements of this discussion and, you know, raising the amount that you lend to borrowers without that much money, as it were. We've had these discussions in the past, I think sort of circa 15 years ago. You know, it's come around again. Where does the balance lie in making sure that property is affordable for people who want to get on the property ladder, government meddling, which is just pushing up prices? I mean, what do we do?
Well, the harsh reality is that if you keep cooking up schemes that lend people more money, then houses won't become more affordable. They will, you will generate the illusion of them being more affordable. The only measure on which they're more affordable is like compared to like your monthly payments and things like that. But those can change. You know, the better measure is the house price to earnings ratio, really. Although some argue with that. They say, no, it just matters what you're paying every month, kind of thing. I think that what you have to do is you have to stop meddling. You let the house prices hit a ceiling and then you see what happens. They either come down, you know, hopefully gently, or they stabilize. And then you get wages to go up, and it takes time to write that scenario, or you get an all-out crash. The problem with desperately trying to stave off house prices falling is you end up with an economy that's massively overly dependent on the property market as it is in the UK, and also you never really deal with the problem. And yes, you might be helping someone right now who is able to buy that house and instead of renting, but you're not helping all the people coming down the line. You're literally just kind of dealing with a snapshot of people in time, and you're actually making the problem worse. So the only way of making the problem better is for houses to become cheaper, and it would take an inordinate amount of time to build your way out of that, just to be clear. The massive amount of supply you need to tackle regional imbalances. Houses are expensive pretty much across the country when you compare them to local wages, but they are much more expensive in some places, and that is because lots more people want to live in certain parts of the country than the other. Maybe some of that will ease off with the whole working from home thing. You know, people don't necessarily need to be so close to those major population centres. But, you know, I mean, that was what the levelling up thing is part of this as well. It's trying to spread the wealth a lot more across the country. It's probably the easiest lever to pull, or the more palatable lever to pull than having house prices crash, which, I mean, let's face it, it's just going to cause a massive recession.
Indeed, which doesn't sound ideal. Look, before we put housing and property to bed, given the rising house prices, you might think investing in property is a no-brainer, especially buy to let. But is it? This is Money Been looking at the pros and the cons. So, Lee, are you ready? Simon, are you ready? Like a good old-fashioned school debate. Lee, you for the cons? Should we say you're for the cons? Simon, you start, and you have to give me the reasons why investing buy to let is a great thing to do, whether you think it or not. Like, we're debating in school here, okay? Okay, Simon, are you ready? Go.
Yes, I can't believe you're making me devil's advocate, the devil being buy-to-let. Right, so people like to invest in things that they know. And in fact, they're advised to invest in things that they know about. And the one thing that most people do know about is property. Bricks and mortar, it's a tangible asset. You can see it. You can do a pretty good job of evaluating whether a property is a good property. Is it in a good location? Is it the kind of property that would appeal to certain people? Not necessarily the one that you'd want to live in, but if you were a young professional couple working in the town or the city nearby, is this the kind of home you'd like? If you were a young family, would this suit you with two young children? It is accessible in the sense that you don't need to raise the entire price of the property. You can get a mortgage in order to do so. You will need to save up a large deposit, probably 25% of the price. You can borrow interest only. The reason being that most buy-to-let mortgages are set up like that because they're an investment. You're not repaying them over time. That means the monthly mortgage payments are cheaper and means that your rent, if you do your sums correctly, should more than outweigh the monthly mortgage payments. If you can find a property where the rent comfortably outweighs the monthly mortgage payments, it can be a good income-generating asset. It's not liquid. You can't sell it quickly. But most people hold on to investments and properties for a long time anyway. And if you do decide to sell it, then you are able to pick your moment and also improve it. Because the great advantage of property over an investment fund is you can't renovate an investment fund. You can't buy into an investment fund and go, do you know what? If I spruce this investment fund up with a bit of new paint here, I maybe knocked that wall down, expanded that room, added a new kitchen, added a new bathroom, tidied things up, I think people wouldn't overlook this investment fund quite so much. And I think they'd find it very attractive, because I think this investment fund's a little bit unloved and it just needs a spruce up. You can do that with a house. You can't do it with all property, but you can do it with some property. And if you are savvy and if you pay attention to what you're doing and you do your numbers right, buy to let can be a good investment. Your gains can be magnified by leverage because you're buying with borrowed money, but you need to be wary that your losses can be as well. So for example, if you borrow with if you put £25,000 down and house prices fall by £25,000 down, £25,000, it's your 25 grand that goes first, you still owe the full mortgage. Homes will always be in demand to rent, and good homes as well. And the best way to be a successful buy-to-let landlord or property investor is to treat your tenants well, look after them and look after the property, and then they will also look after you and your property will always be in demand.
Thank you very much, Simon Lambert. If you'd like to take a seat and up to the pulpit. You don't really have a pulpit, do you? Stand up, Lee Boyce. You are for the opposition. Why is investing in buy-to-let rubbish thing to do?
Before I start this, Georgie, I'm just going to say this outright. A lot of our listeners, a lot of our readers are buy-to-let landlords. So if you're listening to this is just me just giving a
Lee, they understand. They understand. I'm going to give you time afterwards. Don't panic.
Like one in five homes are privately rented. You know, just want to make sure that I'm not, you know, someone's just tuning in now and going, oh, Lee Boyce, why is he putting everyone off?
No.
Just so we're fully aware. Look, there's a couple of things I think that you need to be fully aware of if you're going to become a landlord. And it all depends on your personality and whether or not you'd make a good buy-to-let landlord or not. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. There's a lot of things that you need to consider. And before you, if you're a novice buy-to-let investor, you need to crunch the sums. You need to be looking at those rental yields. You need to be looking at how much a refurbishment cost is going to be for a home that you're buying, and probably double that because it's going to get more expensive than what you think. And just making sure that you've just done all of your due diligence before you just get involved in this thing. Now, in the last few years, it's become a lot less attractive in terms of tax breaks. And there's a 3% stamp duty surcharge on top of the usual stamp duty for one. And having things like annual income against tax wear and tear, that's gone. Mortgage interest tax relief, capital gains when you're selling the property is more than it is for other assets. And you'll especially get stung if you are a higher rate taxpayer. 28% is the level on that. And actually the other thing, of course, is the varying levels of tenants that you can get and you may attract into your property, depending on whereabouts you are in the country. Ideally, you want some working professionals. That's what you really want. Someone who's going to take care of your property, probably not be in it very much. Okay, granted, in current circumstances, that might be a little bit tricky with a lot of people working from home. But when hopefully things get a little bit back to normal, you want people that are probably not going to be in there too much, not create too much wear and tear, and not going to be on call all the time. And that's the thing, as a landlord, if you have one property, or if you have five properties, or if you have 20 properties, you, unless you have someone outsourced to do this, you are on call 24/7. Boiler breaks, what are you going to do? You know, you're gonna have to replace it, could be a couple of grand. There's a really unsexy bit of buy-to-let as well, which is things like gas safety certificates and all of, like, you know, testing the electrics and all of those kind of things that are important but might get overlooked when you are first getting involved in this. And lastly, I think people like to have bricks and mortar. You know, this is Britain. People like to own a home. They like to have an asset they can look at that is physically there, that they can, you know that's theirs. It's just there. And at the end of the day, a lot of people get into this game looking for property price gains, right? And, you know, hoping that the property that they buy is in an area perhaps that's up and coming, you know, that term that gets bandied around, or somewhere where they're going to get some growth. Perhaps it's a place that needs refurbishing. They could do it relatively cheaply. They add value to the home, and then with property prices ticking up, hopefully, if they come to sell it in a decade's time, 20 years' time, whatever, it would have grown nicely in value. And of course, in the last 9 months, as we said earlier in this program, that's what's been going on. You know, properties have been ticking over nicely. But at some point, they could start trickling back down, and then it could become quite a dangerous game if it's, you know, there and actually it's now worth less than you paid for it. So I think all of those things are worth considering. There's a lot of experience buy-to-let investors out there. So if you are someone who's new to the game, I would take advice from people that know best, and they are people that are landlords and have seen it all. And if you are an experienced buy-to-let investor, you know, get in touch with us and we might share some of your tips.
Now I'm going to ask you what you really think. Simon?
I don't think buy-to-let is necessarily a bad investment. I just don't think it's as good an investment as it once was. And I think people look at past returns and they extrapolate that into the future. And so they think, well, house prices have gone up 20 grand in the last year, so I'll make 20 grand next year. And that, yeah, I'd be very wary of doing that. If you do invest in buy-to-let, I think you need to invest for the rental income and maybe work on the basis that you will get some capital gains over the years, and hopefully you will find a property that you can improve. I think that is a real winner to you, and I do genuinely think that the best way to do this is to look after your tenants, and you will probably need a good letting agent as well, unless you're going to be very hands-on and do it all yourself. And I think you also need to bear in mind the tax element as well, and also compare it to what would happen if you put that money somewhere else. So for example, people talk about, oh, my property is my pension. But if you put £75,000 into buying a £300,000 property, the tax man will take £9,000 off you in stamp duty. And that's over and above the normal stamp duty level, which will soon return. Okay, so you'll actually be paying more than that. Whereas if you pay £75,000 into a pension, basic rate tax relief tops it up. You get an extra £18,750 on top of it. So maybe think about that one as well. And remember that most of the gains from buy-to-let, when people say they've made like X amount on property, it's come from is leverage. You're buying with borrowed money.
Lee, what are your real views?
I actually really agree with pretty much everything that Simon just said there. The one thing I would say is that I can't imagine myself ever becoming a landlord, because I simply worry about, I've just had so many nightmare tenant stories. And of course, most people that privately rent are completely reasonable and just want to live somewhere nice and treat the place with respect. But I've heard all sorts of horror stories, and it would massively put me off. But at the end of the day, depending on your circumstances, and as I say, depending on what type of person you are, it can make a good investment, especially in a balanced portfolio. I hate that my property is my pension line. I just don't like it. Just make it part of a balanced portfolio of things that you might have. That would be what I would personally do if I was ever, ever tempted to get involved.
All right. Well done, you two. Now we'll move away from property. Last week, we told you how Barclaycard customers got a bit of a shock when their spending limits were cut pretty drastically without warning, and despite a lot of never missing a payment. A chap who blogs about personal finance told you guys that his credit limit had been cut from 16,100, pretty high, to just 500 quid. That's a 97% reduction. We also discovered last week that Simon had his limit cut, but he wasn't entirely sure by how much, given how little he uses it. There may be something in that, Simon, but I do understand we have some news on that front. Breaking news. First, senior reporter George Nixon has been waiting patiently in the wings. You've been covering this for This Is Money. George.
Hi, Georgie. So this, I discovered this the other Wednesday, and this appears to have been going on sort of since the end of February and throughout March, really, and then into April, is Barclaycard has been writing to, we believe now, about up to 100,000 customers, about half of whom seem to have emailed me in the last few days, saying that their credit limits were being cut, often by really quite large amounts, as you mentioned, 97%, you know, to as low as 250 quid, not enough money to buy a telly, let alone put a holiday on it. Barclaycard has often prefaced these letters by saying to make sure that this is affordable for you. That is the argument. If we're talking about scale of this, Georgie, I would say I've been at This Is Money for about 2.5 years, and this is sort of unprecedented. I have never had this kind of response to anything. When I first started at This Is Money, I worked with Lee on a campaign about private parking charges, which I thought drew people's ire. We got dozens and dozens of emails about that. This is that and then some. At my last counting, I have had 455 emails since Monday on this. Just to read you some from the last 24 hours. This is from Tim Blount. Hi, George. My Barclaycard credit limit has gone from £15,000 to £250, which means the card is worthless to me. This is from Sam Elliott. My Barclay card was reduced from £12,000 to around £8,000. It worries me that this is going to affect my credit rating. I'm now looking to close the account. I haven't had any financial issues due to the pandemic. My salary is substantial and has increased 5% in the last year. And another credit card just given me a £2,000 increase on my credit limit. And this is one last one from a guy called Don Lund. I am disgusted with Barclay card. I am 66 years of age and have been a cardholder since it started. They have reduced my credit limit from £12,000 to £250. I have never, ever missed a payment or gone over my limit, which they have increased over the years without my request. So that's just from the last 24 hours. That gives you a flavour of some of the anger that we have had from people.
To be clear, Barclay Card got rid of the £12 charge in January. But I find this quite difficult because I've actually just written to a friend who was about to put a deposit down for a holiday. And I always say, you know, Section 75 credit
card. What we always
card,
say, isn't it?
Yeah, between £100 to £30,000 back. But I mean, that would not, £250, £500, a couple of £1,000 wouldn't be enough to cover this cost.
I had a comment from a debt advisor who I often speak to about these sort of things. She said, you can hardly spread the cost of a holiday over a course of a year on a credit card if the credit card won't pay for the holiday in the first place, which I think is the point Simon made. £1,000 credit limit won't cover the cost of, wouldn't cost the flights for a family of four.
But this is the important thing. A lot of people who don't use credit cards and are actually quite anti-credit card, I don't have one, and can be quite sniffy about it, and you shouldn't pay money on credit cards. But actually, there is a safety reason, and we've just said that Section 75. What are Barclay cards saying? Why are they doing this?
So there are multiple theories. There is the slightly conspiratorial theory, which has been put forward by some customers, which I'm going to describe as the insufficiently profitable customer theory, which is people who always pay the balance off in full, like many of the people we've just heard from and many of the people that we've spoken to over the last week, who pay it off every month, don't use it that often. So don't get Barclay Card in your revenue in the form of interest payments on the cards, in the form of late payment fees, or in the form of even just spending on the cards, because obviously these banks and credit card providers take a cut of every transaction we make. That is a theory that Barclay Card has very firmly pushed back against and said that is nothing to do with why. Then there is the argument they're saying, which is the responsible lender or kind of credit risk argument, which is thing points to the effect of the pandemic on the UK economy and the slump in spending, which Barclay Card has been content to feed us in the form of its own spending data over the last 12 months, which is quite a nice irony to this whole thing, saying that we have to take into account the effects of the UK economy and how it might impact our borrowers' ability to repay any debt.
A risk issue, right? This is about
exactly.
So then in that regard, George, are all the other credit card companies following suit, or is it particular to be Barclays? And if you're investing, should you be worried? Because this to me sounds like they're more worried about risk than other.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I think every bank has its own credit risk models, right? The irony of this is that Barclay Card is not so concerned about the upcoming state of the UK economy that it is increasing the interest-free term lengths on some of its balance transfer cards at the same time as cutting back people's credit limits, which is interesting. I mean, it seems to me as if, I heard you talking before about this kind of pent-up demand spending spree that we're all supposed to be going on after the pandemic. Perhaps they're trying to kind of clamp down on that a little bit and ensure that people don't go too hard with borrowed money, which they then struggle to pay back. But no, to my knowledge, there doesn't seem to be any other card company doing this sort of thing. Last year, Virgin Money drew a massive backlash, not quite as massive as Barclay Card, but a substantial one nonetheless, after it suspended the credit cards of people, again, creditworthy borrowers during the middle of the pandemic. They reversed course on that 48 hours later because they drew a backlash from customers, from journalists, and from the FCA, most pertinently. There doesn't seem to be a similar volte-face forthcoming from Barclay Card. But no other banks seem to be doing this.
So what do you do then if you're a Barclay Card customer and you've got sort of pittance on your credit limit? I mean, I assume this hasn't impacted credit ratings and you can just get another card and...
Well, it might do because percentage utilisation of credit limits is something that credit reference agencies use to determine your credit score, because the lower the credit limit you use on a card, the better it looks in the eyes of lenders, because it looks like you're not relying on borrowed money too much. So all of a sudden, this could potentially tank people's credit limits, although we'll have to see how that turns out. There are kind of two categories of people affected by this, right? So there are those who can appeal the decision, and if they want to, many people have just decided to cut their cards up and go somewhere else. Fine. If they want to appeal, they can. What they have to do is send kind of income details to Barclaycard. So Barclaycard can check their income and see if they can put their credit limit back, which seems a bit redundant because I feel like maybe that should have been done in the first place. But that's one way of appealing. However, there is a second category of people who cannot appeal because the new limit is higher than the maximum balance they've had on their card at any point over the last 2 years. Those people can't appeal and have to go somewhere else. You probably could appeal to the financial ombudsman as well if Barclaycard fob you off. But again, that could take a very long period of time. And then if this puts you in real financial dire straits, then you can go and get some debt advice as well.
Oh, goodness me, George. Well, thank you very much for coming on. Thank you very much for your work. You've got some emails probably to read now. So off you go. Off you pop.
I'm a freelancer to task to read through them.
Get yourself a PA, George. Simon, what do you think of it? You're a Barclaycard customer, aren't you?
I am, and we discussed this on last week's podcast.
I said that
after the story, I remembered these garbled text messages that I'd had from Barclaycard in early March. So I just figured, was it having some kind of meltdown? Because it sent me one saying my credit limit was being lowered. It sent me another saying my account was being closed, and it sent me another apologising for sending me the first two. So I was like, well, you know, I mean, the thing is, banks text you nonsense and send you an absolute load of guff through the post regularly. Barclaycard is guilty of this and has been regularly putting up my credit card limit, you know, 500 quid here, £1,000 there for years without even asking me. So I must admit, I thought, well, if they've lowered it, it's not gone down by much. So I said I was off to get angry, call up Barclaycard, work out what was going on, and get annoyed. Yeah, it turned out I did get annoyed. So they did send me a letter. Unfortunately, the letter went to my old address. Now, I had updated my address with Barclaycard on the 15th of February. They sent a letter. Unfortunately, the date on the top of the letter, again, another one of these like generic things, it just says February 2021. It doesn't say a day. I don't know where the people at Barclaycard went to letter writing school, but the way you write the date is you actually put the day in there as well. You don't just put the month when you send someone a letter. And so there's no way of knowing whether these things just crossed or whether they accidentally sent it to my old address or whatever. The text message that came to me was in early March. So I'd changed my address long before that. Anyway, the people at Barclaycard admitted that obviously these two things had crossed. But the problem is the letter was telling me that my credit limit was being reduced from £8,500, which is more than I would ever need and is largely thanks to Barclaycard having ratcheted it up over the years willy-nilly without asking me whether I wanted it. I had to opt out rather than opt in, to £1,000, which is pretty much useless in terms of things that I might use a credit card for, a big purchase, buying flights for my family of four in the school holidays. Unfortunately, we have to go on holiday in the school holidays, so flights tend to cost more than £1,000 for the four of us and things like that. And that was happening on the 7th of April. Now, the letter said, to keep your current credit limit, all you need to do is text current and your unique reference number to 60268, comma, and I state the comma here because this is important, or spend on your card before 31st of March 2021. So I called them up and they said that because I called them up after the 31st of March 2021, it already happened and they couldn't do anything about it. I said, well, we've already obviously established that there was a mix-up with the letter and I didn't know about it. Nope, date's gone, can't do anything about it. Well, why not? Why can't I just put it back up? Date's gone, can't do anything about it. And you can't apply for a new credit limit for at least 4 months. Why? Because you can't. Oh, well, why not? Because you can't. But you've already admitted there was a problem with the letter. You can't. I was like, okay, can I make a complaint? Yes. Someone from our complaints team will send you a letter within 4 days. Great. The thing is, I said, why have you lowered my limit by so much? I said, I get why you might lower it by a little bit, because like, it's ridiculously high anyway, but why have you lowered it by so much? And because of the financial impact of the coronavirus pandemic? I was like, but have you actually checked on my finances? I said, because I'm in the fortunate position where I haven't really been affected financially by the coronavirus pandemic. No. Do you actually have my earnings on file? No. Do you have anything about my earnings ever on file? No. So why have you rendered my Barclay card almost useless? Is this just because I don't make you enough money? No, we looked at your spending over the last 2 years. I was like, well, obviously I didn't really spend much over the last 2 years. It's been illegal to leave the house for a large part of it. And I can't go on holiday. And, you know, so why wouldn't you look at it over a longer period? And also that's illogical. So what you're telling me is if I'd have spent more over the last year, you wouldn't have dropped my limit by as much. But if I'd have spent more over the last year when it was illegal to leave the house, I would be more likely to be in financial difficulty. And also this nonsense that you're giving me about it's due to the financial impact of coronavirus on people's circumstances is absolute garbage, because you've just told me that I could keep the limit if I spent more money. If you were genuinely concerned about the financial impacts of coronavirus on my circumstances, you wouldn't tell me I could keep my credit limit by spending more money. I have no problem with a private business deciding that I am not profitable enough as a customer, lowering my limit. Okay, I have a little bit of a problem because I've been a customer for more than 20 years and I think I deserve better than that. But, you know, more fool me. They're a private business. So they're mercantile, whatever. What I have a problem with is being fobbed off with weasel words of absolute nonsense. This impact of the coronavirus pandemic on people's finances. Reader after reader after reader has emailed us and told us that they are furious because they've been Barclay card customers for years. They've never missed a payment. Their financial circumstances haven't changed. And in fact, in some instances have improved. And Barclay card has never checked on their financial circumstances, but has slashed their credit limit to the point where it's almost pointless having it. Now, I don't know what's going on here or why they did it. Someone somewhere thought this was a good idea. And I think that someone is probably thinking that maybe it wasn't such a good idea now, because the thing is, you know, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe in that meeting behind closed doors or whatever, they were like, well, you know what, if these people complain, it doesn't matter that much because they're not that profitable to us. They've got this annoying habit of borrowing money and then paying it all back. And we don't really earn any interest on them. But the backlash has been huge. Barclay Card has managed to garner a vast quantity of very, very bad press for treating its customers badly. And people remember that kind of stuff. So, you know, is it even the customers? No, it's more like all the other people. And it's just, it's as a customer, it's infuriating. Actually, you know, as a journalist looking at this problem, it's infuriating. And a lot of the complaints, really the comments we're getting, people are saying this is just, you know, classic credit card company, classic bank kind of thing. And also it's completely illogical, as I said, to tell people that you're lowering their credit limit due to concerns over their financial circumstances, but they could keep the old one if they spend some money. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense.
I wish I brought the popcorn, Simon, because that was a spectacular rant. I think we all really enjoyed that. So while Simon just calms down a little bit, Lee, just briefly, what impact do you think this is going to have on Barclays and Barclay Card?
Well, it's just walked its way into sort of a bit of a PR disaster, if I'm being quite honest, Georgie. I mean, the first thing as an average person on the street will go, well, are all these credit limits being reduced because there's some sort of problem? Is there something going on behind the scenes? Because these have been brutal cuts, like really quite brutal. Now, look, at the end of the day, credit card providers, financial services, whoever, they can make their own decisions, you know, and at the end of the day, if they want to reduce people's credit limits, that is their prerogative. But there's a way of properly going about it, I would argue. It's angered people because they see it as almost like a personal attack, is my opinion. So if you've got a £10,000 credit limit, and let's face it, most people get a credit card and then the limit gets bumped up and up and up without asking, without question, and you have to opt out of it. So we've built these people up, and then to turn around and say, right, it's getting reduced by 90%. Here, you now have a £1,000 credit limit. It's almost like a personal attack, isn't it? It's almost like, what are you saying that my financial circumstances aren't good enough for you now? And I think a lot of people, a lot of our readers, a lot of people this is affected, have never been asked for any kind of evidence, you know, in decades of their finances. And it's just not a good look, Georgie. It's not a good look. At the end of the day, I think a lot of people will close their accounts. There's a lot of other credit card providers out there who offer, you know, certain rewards for spending and all that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, if this has annoyed you, I would just look elsewhere. Just get out there. You know, at the end of the day, Simon hit the nail on the head. If you're not profitable to a credit card company, they probably don't want you. You know, at the end of the day, they rely on people to miss payments, to get stung with high APRs. And we've seen actually evidence in the last year since the pandemic started that credit card debt is being paid off at sort of record levels. Maybe people have just reached the top of the credit pile and have decided actually they don't want to just rely on credit, to rely on plastic, pay this down, get rid of it.
There is also potentially a regulatory thing going on here behind the scenes that perhaps Barclaycard isn't admitting to, in that, you know, effectively, there are Barclaycard, when it's watching its own finances, does need to look at the, you know, collective amount of credit it has promised to lend people. So not the amount that people have taken out, but the prospective amount of credit. That if everybody suddenly maxed out their credit limits, how much money would Barclaycard be lending out? And there is a possibility that that figure has become too high for Barclaycard in aggregate. Certainly, I mean, if you look at maybe Barclaycard's been more guilty of ratcheting people's credit limits up by larger amounts over the years and then has suddenly had a bit of a wake-up call or something. I mean, as I said in my column this week, I took my credit card out 24 years ago, nearly. But yeah, before I went to go work in France as a barman in the French Alps to do a snowboard season. And I'm pretty sure that my credit limit is now back to the level it was at then. And I was earning £80 a week back then, plus board, lodging, and a free season ski pass. And I'm not going to divulge what Mrs. Money pays me, but it is more than that. Good. Although I don't get a ski pass anymore.
Yeah. I mean, the location, not ideal, but
To be fair, the resort's been warmer. Shot all season, so.
Right, I'm going to lift the spirits a little bit and change the subject now. We're going to talk about how to pimp up your shoffice eco-style. We have a letter from one of your readers. They want to build an office at the end of the garden complete with solar panels on the roof. But would it produce enough energy to power your bog-standard office equipment fare? You know, just some lights and a laptop and whatever else you need, printer. Would they need planning permission? And is there a more efficient way to heat the outbuilding? Lee?
Georgia, I mean, I'm going to be quite frank with this. Unless you're buying your solar panels for your shed with a Barclaycard, I'm not interested. I looked at this story, I read this story, and having solar panels on one of these sort of shoffices, you know, we spoke a couple of weeks ago about working from home and the return to office life. And one of the parts of that, we were talking about people buying these shed offices as a way to sort of escape from your main home and have that divide between work, office and home. I think it's going one step to a bit of bonkersness if you're thinking about putting solar panels on top of it. Now, the reason why I say that is because solar panels are quite heavy and these buildings are pretty small, pretty stout little sort of shoffices, unless you're going for something pretty substantial. And because they're small spaces, in order to heat them properly, it shouldn't really take much, as in a portable heater in the winter should be enough for you to heat the space and for it to be in a nice condition. The actual important thing is, as we mentioned in the podcast a couple of weeks ago, is insulation and having the right kind of tools in there, the right kind of equipment in there and stuff to make sure that it is a year-round building, you know, as in it might be pleasant in the summer or it might be pleasantly unhot. But then it might be too cold in the winter. It's just, if you get that right in the first instance, you really shouldn't need to be installing solar panels that cost quite a bit of money to power it. Now, people, of course, you've got the heating element and then you've got the element of needing plug points, perhaps, for example. But again, for the majority of people that are using this as an office, you'd have a charged laptop and you would probably go and take it into your office. And you know, there might be times when you need to charge it, but most of these devices now have a pretty long battery life on them. The actual really important thing is making sure that you've got Wi-Fi connection, I would argue, and making sure that you've got a strong enough, you know, dongle that can make all this happen. If you're really, really set on getting solar panels into put onto one of these buildings, I would argue that you'd be better off looking at getting it for your main home first and seeing how that goes before sticking them on a building like this. It probably won't need planning permission. And again, we spoke about this the other week about what you can legally get away with in terms of, you know, having an outbuilding like this and what you need and how it needs to be away from the boundary and all of that kind of stuff. If anyone out there has done this, has put solar panels on their shop list, please let us know, because I just can't imagine it. I really can't. When you asked the question, should you, I just really just wanted to say no and then stop. If I'm being honest, I think you've really, really got to crunch the mass on it, because it is expensive. I think a lot of people think of a shed that, you know, before we talk about shoffice, like, you know, a shed office, then most people just think of a little wooden shed. That those things need re-roofing all the time, because the elements, you know, they're just exposed and they just fall apart. Now, a shoffice is a little bit different. And again, listen to the podcast a few weeks ago about all of the different materials that you can make your shoffice out. I'm not repeating all of that again.
No need.
And probably, depending on how much money you spend, it will be okay to get a solar panel or two on there. You know, but again, you've got to think about the positioning of your garden. If it's not south facing where you're going to put it, probably not worth it. How much sun are you getting in that garden? Is it under a tree? Is it, you know, all of these sorts of considerations before even getting a shoffice, let alone sticking a solar panel on top of it. I mean, honestly. Oh.
All right, well, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or solar panels on your shoffice, anything else you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at thisismoney.co.uk. Sorry, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can join in the debate in thisismoney.co.uk/podcasts in the reader comments. And if you do want to solar panel your shoffice, then you might, as Lee said, consider solar paneling your house first. You do need to look into things like inverters and batteries and stuff like that. Maybe you want to go the full hog and get a Tesla Powerwall, or maybe you should look Google solar panels for canal boats, because that is the place that you do see solar panels being used like that. And I reckon that might be the easiest way to rig up a DIY job. But it's probably, as Lee said, it's probably going to cost you far more money than you're actually going to save.
Indeed. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.